From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, where Michigan stands with COVID infections, vaccinations, and power machinations.
Patience, I think, is a word that that I've heard when I've talked to officials. People want to get to this 70% goal. They want to get to no masks. They want to get to complete no capacity restrictions as fast as possible. And that's like the biggest frustration at this point is how to get there as fast and safely as possible.
Then we explore Ernest Hemingway's summers in northern Michigan.
When they came up here to northern Michigan, it was kind of, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story.
Also, West Michigan musician Jess Kramer on performance as therapy and her workarounds during COVID. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, musician Jess Kramer talks about her very own form of onstage therapy.
I mean, that's the funny thing about performing is that anxiety is expected, right? So the stage fright and finding ways to just push through it, it's part of the process, and it's like a very rewarding part of the process.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, have you looked at the heat map of Michigan COVID infections lately? It's blue! Not to say we don't still have some areas of concern and hospitalizations, but the state has come a long way from the days when our funeral homes and ICUs were bursting. This is good news, but the data also needs a little bit of unpacking. And here to help us with some of the nuances is Dave Boucher. He covers government and politics for the Detroit Free Press. Dave, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So Monday's updated numbers show us that Michigan has had less than 3% positivity for six consecutive days. Is that the first time that our test rates have fallen that low since the pandemic began?
You know, the test rates that you're talking about are definitely low. It's not the lowest that they've ever been. There's questions about, you know, the capacity to do testing at the beginning of the pandemic and what that actually means. So actually, at about this point last year in June of 2020, it was a comparable test rate, but it's, as you noted, it's worlds better than what we saw just weeks ago when we were experiencing another surge of the pandemic.
I suppose we ought to remind folks that positivity rate, you know, this has a meaning that's worth noting. We're not talking about the percentage of Michiganders who have COVID, right? This is the percentage of people who have been tested and tested positive.
That's exactly right. The number of people, they're doing a certain number of tests every day, and it's the percentage of those that are coming back positive.
So, Dave, what do the state's health officials attribute numbers like this to right now?
All about vaccinations. Everybody at the state health department and the governor's office has been touting the efficacy of vaccines for months at this point, and they're saying Michiganders are listening. They've obviously encouraged more people to get vaccinated, and vaccination rates have kind of slowed down and dropped down a bit, but all officials are pointing to the fact that, you know, we're seeing this drop in spread, the drop in cases, the drop in outbreaks due to people getting vaccinated.
Yeah, we have heard several times that Michigan's vaccination rate is not where the Whitmer administration would like it to be. I want to say we're close to 60% of those Michiganders being eligible having had at least one dose. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it's close. It's as you said, the math here is a little bit all over the place, but the original metric was trying to get to 70% of Michigan residents who are 16 and older to get vaccinated. If you're looking at those numbers, we're, like you said, almost at 60%. After the creation of that goal, federal regulators allowed people who are as young as 12 to get a vaccine. And so that kind of opened up the population of eligible Michiganders. We're closer to about 55%. Of Michiganders who are 12 or older who've had at least one dose of the vaccine. So that's about 4.6, 4.7 million residents. So again, still a ways to go to get to that 70% number, but we're already seeing the impact and the effect of that many people getting vaccinated.
Yeah. It's, we're at a place right now where the business curfew that has been affecting many restaurants and bars, for example, has been lifted. And we're looking at full capacity, I believe, by July 1st. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the plan. What we've been told is that the state health department is essentially rolling back all of its regulations related to capacity and masking. Many of those are already gone or have been eased considerably with an order that came out earlier this month. But yep, the understanding is that essentially all of those pandemic orders that have, you know, depending on your view, helped save lives or strangled businesses will be repealed or greatly reduced starting in July.
Yeah. When you hear people with MDHHS or other departments in state government, when you hear them talk about that gap between the roughly 60% vaccination rate we have now and the 70%, which was the target, do they talk about that as a consequential gap?
Absolutely. And it's a gap that is disproportionate throughout the state. You know, so the focus has been, at least for the last month or two, from state level officials on getting into communities that are well below that 60% rate or well below the state average. So there are certain communities that have been hesitant or resident to get vaccines. The state has focused on Black Michiganders, some in Detroit, some in Wayne County, but there's also been residents, conservatives in Michigan, who are reticent to get that vaccine for whatever reason. So people with the state health department have focused a lot on clinics going out in Detroit or other areas, or to help people that have been homebound, while also asking conservative leaders of the legislature to reach out to constituents in their own party to encourage them to go out and get these vaccines.
What's the vibe from Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration about what might happen over the next couple of weeks? Do you sense any tension around what we'll see once the record keeping catches up with what's going on right now and maybe show us what happened when businesses went to higher capacity and people started taking their masks off?
I don't know if tension is the word. I think that people are anxious to get to the point where these orders are rolled back. If there's any tension that we've seen, it was in the months leading up to orders that started to roll back some of these restrictions. And that's frankly what led to the departure of the former director of the Health and Human Services Department, Director Robert Gordon. Since Elizabeth Hertel has taken over, we've seen this pretty, what started as a gradual and has since become a relatively drastic rollback of these restrictions. And at this point, patience, I think, is a word that I've heard when I've talked to officials. People want to get to this 70% goal. They want to get to no masks. They want to get to complete no capacity restrictions as fast as possible. And that's like the biggest frustration at this point is how to get there as fast and safely as possible.
I wanted to ask you a few things about the broader picture within Michigan's government. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson has been catching fire from some Republicans for maintaining an appointment system for people who need to come and deal with driver's licenses or related paperwork. This is something that Benson instituted at the, you know, the outset of the pandemic when nobody, you know, thought it would be very safe to be in person. Do you get a sense that there are differences across Michigan's arms of state government in how they are receiving the public and sort of how they're dealing with a rollback right now?
Yeah, I think that there are differences in every in any industry, including state government. So, as you know, Secretary Benson announced in April that the Secretary of State's office is going to keep this online appointment system as opposed to like the take a number and wait system. She's faced backlash. There's also a huge backlog that she attributes in no small part to historical divestment from her department by the legislature. She announced some changes today that she says will free up about 350,000 appointments that'll help kind of expedite that process. But yeah, to your point, depending on who you talk to, more people are ready to move forward with, you know, opening capacity, and others are still, you know, saying that they're a little bit hesitant. We're seeing it in the business community as well, especially when it comes to masking or whether or not to require a vaccine for entry. It's kind of a common discussion happening all over Michigan and the country.
It seems like the example of the Secretary of State's offices is sort of an interesting case of a change that is not at the end of the day about COVID in the sense that Benson wants to keep doing it this way, but it becoming seen through the lens of COVID and the battle lines that have been drawn between the right and the left. Do you get a sense that COVID will become any less political over the summer and into the fall?
Absolutely not. No, there's no indication, especially at the legislative or the state government level, that it will. You know, we've seen, for example, the Michigan House just passed a bill that would ban government mandated or sponsored vaccine passports. despite the fact that the health department and the governor have said that they're not considering any sort of vaccine mandate. That entire debate was not only was it political, but it was also peppered with conspiracy theories and lies, frankly, that came up during legislative hearings. There's, again, no indication that there will be less politicization, especially as the legislature and local communities figure out what to do and how to spend billions of dollars in federal COVID relief. Anytime you talk about how to spend money and how to, you know, what your priority should be, politics absolutely becomes a part of that. So, you know, we're hearing from legislative leaders in the governor's office that perhaps they're finding a way to find a compromise on how to spend that money, but it'll definitely be political.
Dave, this time has been such a crucible for everybody in Lansing. You know, observers sometimes say that Gretchen Whitmer hit her stride as an executive during the early months of the pandemic. At the same time, she and Republicans in the legislature have been at it nonstop, and we could say that Mike Shirkey kind of hit his own stride in terms of opposition to Whitmer over pandemic issues and public health issues. Is there anything you can tell us about what Whitmer and what the legislative leadership want to get done most right now? And whether these experiences of the pandemic have fundamentally altered what they're trying to do?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good question. I think that as lawmakers go into any legislative session, they have broad ideas about topics that they want to address, and then things happen that make them pivot or require them to look at something else that they want to address. So for example, the biggest priority coming out of Mike Shirkey's Republican caucus in the Senate has been election reform, right? That has been the big talking point for them. And House Democrats came out today with a big package looking at criminal justice reform. But everybody is focused on how to use billions of dollars in one-time COVID relief and the impact that that money can have on the state of Michigan. So I think right now, everybody's first priority, or at least the thing that they're getting the most questions about, is how the legislature and the governor are going to work together to determine how to spend that money. Now, there are other priorities, but that money is still just a huge priority and an issue for everyone.
Dave Boucher covers politics for the Detroit Free Press. Dave, take care.
Thank you.
Next up, Summer Idols in Hemingway's, Michigan.
It was those 23 consecutive years that he spent here in northern Michigan that I think really shaped not only his writing, but really had a major influence on his personal life also.
We'll talk about the forests and lakes that inspired some of the writer's most indelible stories. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ernest Hemingway spent many summers in northern Michigan. Much of his writing reflects on his time among the waters and forests near Petoskey. He chose up north to recuperate after being wounded in World War I. He started his career as a writer of fiction here, and it was the scene of his first wedding. Today, we're going to revisit a conversation about Hemingway's Michigan roots with Christopher Strubel. He is president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Will you paint a picture for us of the area where Hemingway spent his summers?
Yeah, it's kind of just like it is now. We have these beautiful lakes that were carved out when the glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, all this fresh water. And that was a boom for tourism in the 1890s. Lumbering had pretty much cleared the whole area, and they were looking for a way to revitalize the area, and tourism was the way. And they sent out a lot of promo stuff to Kansas City, Chicago, and St. Louis. And, of course, the Hemingways were one of those families that came from the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, and found their way up here the first time in 1898. Dr. Clarence Hemingway and his wife, Grace, who was an opera singer who actually made a little bit more money than her husband did, they rode the lake that morning before they headed out, and they found a beautiful piece of land that was 375 feet long, beautiful sloping sandy beach. They had a child and then one on the way, and they wanted to make sure when they returned the next summer in 1899, Hemingway's first year up here, that they had a nice, safe beach. Dr. Clarence Hemingway was always concerned about the children drowning over the years, so he picked what I would consider probably the best beach on all of Walloon. They paid around $250 for 375 feet. If you were to compare that to today's average, it's about $14,000 a foot out there when you have parcels of 100 feet or more. So pretty good investment.
My gosh. Do folks who are in the area and who've lived there a long time, do you run into folks who remember Hemingway today?
You know, we do. He's 123 years old. 100. So it's this summer would be 122. So 123rd year he would have been up here. But we still have a few people that remember him or remembering him. You know, so these memories get a little convoluted a little bit. Ernest Mainland, who was his nephew, he just passed away this year, and he was one of the only family members that actually are still alive that met Hemingway. But he often said that he's not sure if his memories were his own or memories that he heard afterwards, you know, from his mother. And then we had a local legend here, Irene Gordon. So in the time that I've lived in northern Michigan, Irene Gordon and Judge Ned Fenlon both lived to be collectively like 107 years old. So I've heard Ned Fenlon say that damn Hemingway stole my girlfriend from me. Must be something in the water up here as far as longevity.
Yeah. You have said that it's hard to find a Hemingway story that doesn't mention Michigan to some degree. Let's start with one that's actually titled Up in Michigan.
Yeah, great one.
Yeah, this was perhaps one of his more controversial, especially for its time.
That's saying something for Hemingway, right? One of his most controversial.
Right. Where did it take place?
It, you know, I was talking with the owners last night. It took place in Horton Bay at the Dilworth Cottage. And the Dilworth Cottages were comprised of Shangri-La and Pinehurst, and they served chicken dinners there. It was one of the more well-known resort communities in northern Michigan, and it was just three houses kind of combined there. The houses are still almost exactly as they were during Hemingway's time. Shangri-La is actually for rent. It's a summer rental, and it's one of those places where you can really experience Hemingway. It's one of those rare opportunities to sit there and read Hemingway in a house where Hemingway would have sat while he was thinking about writing Hemingway. It's a really, really unique locale, very much preserved the way it was. There's a lot of wetlands there. And so just by happenstance, some of these areas have been preserved with no connection to Hemingway just because of the way things happened. So it's just, it's really cool how authentic the area is up here to this day.
Let's listen to a clip from the Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary titled Hemingway.
I think Up in Michigan is very important because, first of all, he is saying there are no boundaries. I'm going to write with no boundaries, no restrictions. I'm not going to listen to you, polite world. I'm going to what I think is true. But I'm going to see it from the point of view of the woman.
Liz Coates is a teenaged girl working in a boarding house in the tiny town of Horton's Bay. Among the boarders is a handsome young blacksmith named Jim Gilmore. One evening, they go down to the dock.
"Don't, Jim," Liz said. Jim slid the hand further up. "You mustn't, Jim. You mustn't." Neither Jim nor Jim's big hand paid any attention to her.
The story concerns Jim Gilmore, a blacksmith who comes to Horton's Bay, and Liz Coates, a young woman who's got a crush on him. At risk of giving away the plot of the story, there's a rape involved. And there are a real Jim and Liz, I understand, who were in fact very dear family friends and had cottages where Hemingway would stay. Do you have any idea of how folks in the area reacted to that story, or, you know, sort of the mores that were reflected in it?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, for its time, Gertrude Stein said this story is unpublishable, even in that time. And of course, now with the cancel culture, who knows, you know, how that would be perceived. But, you know, we kind of try to take things in context of when it was written. But even at that time, it was still controversial. Jim and Liz were great family friends of the Hemingways. And it's interesting that Hemingway often wrote in several stories that it wasn't time to talk about these things because these people were still alive. But yet in Up in Michigan, which was first written in 1921, the same year he would have stayed there for his wedding, he chose to use Jim and Liz by their first name. And in the original copy, he actually had the Dilworth's name written there, but he penciled that out and then changed it to Gilmore. So he really was, you know, incorporating them into the story. But that was part of his whole writing technique, was to write what you really know. And those early sketches that were so great were really things that he had experienced throughout his life. Now, of course, this scenario that happens in the story, again, without giving out the plot, it never took place. They were already a married, established couple by the time Hemingway met them, and he called them Uncle Jim and Aunt Liz. And when the story came out, there was quite a bit of controversy, not so much locally, but more internationally. And then, of course, this was the first of two big fallouts that happened in that summer with his parents. When his mother read the story, she couldn't believe that he had incorporated the names, and his sister Marceline felt the same way. You know, these were family friends, and to put them in that scenario was kind of a little bit, just maybe a little bit taboo.
Did Ernest Hemingway ever say why he did that?
You know, he didn't, and it kind of goes back to another story that involves Marge Bump. And we're talking with Marge, and that was another kind of a controversial story about a breakup of a relationship that never happened. And Marge, her son's 91 years old. He's one of those people that still remembers meeting Hemingway. And Hemingway made a visit to their house in Florida in the 50s. And the, you know, the talk of the table that evening was, why did you use my real name? And he was always usually very particular about not really, you know, divulging who the actual person was. He would change names around a little bit, but yet here Marge Bump shows up as Marge Bump. As Sid remembers, Hemingway proceeded to drink all the gin in the house, and then they settled the score and everything was fine. But for some reason, in those two stories, he chose to use actual people, even though he was very sensitive about the fact that could be a little bit off limits. Hmm. And, but, you know, Jim and Liz, they kind of responded with a laugh. Here, he's a blacksmith, the real Jim, and the real Liz, and she serves chicken dinners at the Dilworth Cottage. And all of a sudden, here they are in the center of a international kind of controversy, a literary controversy, and they thought it was a little bit humorous, actually.
Jeez. There are other stories, Summer People from the Nick Adams series, and also Wedding Day. And Northern Michigan was the site of the actual wedding luncheon for Hemingway and his bride at the time, Hadley Richardson. Do you have a favorite Michigan-specific story in the canon?
Yeah, and you just mentioned it, and it's actually probably the first time that Nick Adams appears in fiction, and that's Summer People. That's one of my favorite stories, and it just really captures that freedom that he always talked about in Northern Michigan. You know, he came from a kind of a strict and regimented upbringing, so much in Oak Park to a certain extent. But when they came up here to Northern Michigan, it was kind of, you know, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story. And if you were to kind of really analyze The Sun Also Rises and compare it to Summer People, you'll see so many similarities between those stories, in my opinion. And it was just the first one that really caught my attention. And it's probably one of my all-time favorite stories, right behind The Sun Also Rises, coincidentally. Yeah, so Summer People would be my favorite Nick Adams story and Michigan sketch. And when you walk down that beach and that stretch of road today, it's just like it was at that time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with president of the Michigan Hemingway Society, Christopher Strubel. He's giving us sort of a verbal tour through some of the favorite woods and forests that Ernest Hemingway visited and enjoyed up north. I'm inferring from something you said earlier that the Hemingway cottage has never left the family?
No, it went to Hemingway after his father committed suicide, unfortunately, in 1928. Hemingway officially took ownership in 1935. Even though it was deeded to him or unofficially deeded to him at the passing of Clarence. And then when Hemingway passed away, it laid in limbo for a little while longer until his sister, Sonny, took over the cottage. And she lived there until her passing. And then it transferred to her only son, who was Hemingway's namesake, Ernest Miller Hemingway Mainland, who just recently passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago. So it's still in the family and just kind of wondering what's going to happen in the next generation.
Is there any clarity about the estate at this point?
No, it's just a little too soon to sort of make these inquisitions. And so we're just, or inquiries, I'm sorry, but we're just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah. What would you like to see happen with it?
You know, at one time I thought it was really going to transfer to one of the major universities in the country, and there was a little bit of scandal involved with that university, and I was kind of maybe sidestepped that a little bit, but I'd love to see it preserved in a way that could be shared by the scholars and the fans of Hemingway and still maybe remain in possession of the family to a certain extent also. Kind of looking for the perfect balance would be my preference. It's just such an honor when you get a chance to go in there. And over the last 3-4 decades, it's not uncommon to have people show up out front. And of course, everybody wants to see this, that's a Hemingway fan. But looking at it from the point of the former owner, Ernie Mainland, one time he was in the shower and he remembers hearing people in the living room. He came out and here's this group of tourists in his front living room. So it's on the state of historic, or it's on the list of historical residences in the United States, but it's still a private residence.
Wait, they just walked in?
They just walked in. And when he told them they had to leave, they said, well, we're going to talk to the neighbors about this. Kind of.
Is the cottage, as Ernie Mainland maintained it, has it changed very much from the days when Ernest Hemingway spent time there?
No, but that's not without some tender, loving care. In 1997, I want to say, they started some major renovations. The place sat pretty much vacant for, probably the better part of 20 years, maybe even a little longer. And as places in northern Michigan, this happens in a nice, moist, wet environment with heavy winters. The cottage suffered quite a bit of internal damage and some stuff with the foundation. And they started a very comprehensive renovation process in the 1997 period, which was finished by the time of 1999, which was the centennial of Hemingway's birth. And that's when I first toured the cottage. But they painstakingly really took great care to maintain all the integrity of the cottage. And there's traces of him throughout the cottage. That there's no doubt about that.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so when Hemingway was wounded in World War I, one of the things that he was known for was he was a bit superstitious, and he always wore a good luck charm. And that fateful day, he had a Oak Park track medal on his chest. He was wearing on a chain as a good luck charm, and that piece suffered quite a bit of damage from a piece of shrapnel that would have been a fatal wound to the chest. And they have that framed, and it's in the cottage right next to the windowsill where he used to sleep. There's little marks around the house where Clarence had stopped doors from swinging because the cottage was slightly off level. I'd say all in all, when you're inside the cottage, you're looking at about 90% authenticity of the time of Hemingway's time in the cottage, right down to the thing that caught me the most. And I really appreciated this because in my childhood, we did the same as many people do in their cottages. There's a board next to the door, and it shows all the family members at different heights throughout the summers that they spent there. And that's preserved as it was. And Hemingway's final marker was probably about 6'1".
You take people on walking tours of people come from all over the world, really, to come see the waters and the forests that Hemingway loved and that he wrote about. Christopher, has the land changed very much in all these years?
So we have places that obviously have changed, but when you get out to Horton Bay for the Nick Adams tour, which is a more extensive tour that we do, it's probably like a 2.5-hour tour. We go out to Hemingway country. Really, the only thing that's changed out there is the trees are a little bit taller. The lumbering years did quite a bit of damage up here. And when Hemingway was here, it was kind of that second growth kind of coming up. And the one thing we say now is we pretty much have the authentic setting in the woods, but the trees are a little bit taller. Now, in 1905, his mother purchased a big piece of property on the opposite side of the land, of the lake, and it was about 1,700 feet of property, again, for a really good value. And it was a 40-acre farm, and she ultimately built her own cottage over there. The cottage still stands, but Longfield Farm, which is what they called the farm at that time, that's pretty much mega million mansions, cottages, these amazing summer cottages there. So that piece of property has very much been developed. But just to the west of that is Camp Michigania, the University of Michigan's retreat, summer retreat. And they've accumulated a lot of that Hemingway farm property. So that's all pristine and preserved the way it was during Hemingway's time.
Hmm. Is there a favorite place that you go to when you need a little time away?
Yeah, and that's the nice thing is you can slip out of town here and you can hit Horton Bay. And within 15 minutes of leaving downtown Petoskey, you can find yourself at the Nick Adams Preserve. Walk down to Horton Creek and you can really experience that setting that he would have loved. Pretty much what he captures in the big Two-Hearted River, the same essence is right there in Horton Bay as we speak. And then if I'm really lucky and really fortunate, I spend a couple, 3 or 4 days in Shangri-La, one of the Dilworth's cottages, and read Hemingway while I'm sitting on the couch next to the stairway that he sneaks up after his liaison in Summer People.
Christopher Struble is president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, thanks so much for telling us a little bit more about these areas and what makes them special.
Well, thank you for having me. And again, this is my passion up here. And when it comes to Hemingway, I appreciate Cuba and Spain and Paris and all the places he's known to have spent so much time. But it was those 23 consecutive years that he spent here in Northern Michigan that I think really shaped not only his writing, but really had a major influence on his personal life also.
If you've got some time to spare on Thursday morning, we've got a hot tip for you. Most of Michigan should be able to witness a partial solar eclipse beginning right around sunrise. This one won't be quite as dramatic as the total solar eclipse we got to see in 2018, but trust me, it will be an eyeful. This one is referred to as a ring of fire for the way that the moon will partly shield the sun. If you live on the eastern edge of the Mitten or the UP, you're in luck. Starting at 5:55 a.m., if you put on a pair of certified safe eclipse watching goggles, you'll see the disk of the moon slipping over the sunrise. It should stay visible until a little after 9 a.m., according to astronomers. If you can't get goggles, another cool way to watch is through the light that filters to the ground through the leaves of trees. All those double and triple shadows, they're pretty amazing. Of course, if 5:55 is too early for you, or if you can't get yourself high enough off the ground for an unobstructed view of the sunrise, you can always wait till 2023. That's when NASA says North America will get our next look at a solar eclipse. Up next, one musician from West Michigan talks about the stage as a place to process.
I mean, that's the funny thing about performing is that anxiety is expected, right? So the stage fright and finding ways to just push through it, it's part of the process.
We'll meet Jen Kramer after a short break. Be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. I want you to imagine standing on stage in front of an audience. You're singing and you're vibing and you're playing that keyboard like you have done so many times before. And the crowd is really feeling it too. But what nobody knows is that while you're playing, you're also conducting your own therapy exercise. With every stroke of your fingers, left to right, you're working through anxieties. Performer Jess Kramer practices something called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR. It's a tool that people use to process anxiety, and it involves tapping the left and right hands to stimulate the left and right parts of our brains. So when a pandemic forces us to totally reimagine so many things, home space, our creative inspirations, our work, onstage therapy sometimes has to go through some changes too. Jess Kramer joins us now to talk more about her creative life and how it's changed since the pandemic. Jess, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When did you start performing?
I have been performing original music live since I was a senior in high school. So that was 2005. And I have not stopped ever since for more than a few months at a time. So it's been a really consistent thing in my adulthood.
It's been a consistent practice, but has music and performing music for others, has that been for consistent reasons over time? Have you felt in a consistent way about it?
I have, you know, for the most part, I was surprised by how much that connection gave back to me when I started doing it when I was, you know, 17 years old. And I think I almost became addicted to it, right? Of this idea of presenting something so personal in a sharing space with others and getting immediate feedback and seeing if they're reacting. And so for me, it was a way of, yeah, connecting to the people, who I may or may not have known with personal stories and sort of, you know, finding that common human ground.
So then, I'm guessing this is a parallel track, but not necessarily that runs in the same direction. How did you realize that you were dealing with anxiety?
I mean, that's the funny thing about performing is that anxiety is expected, right? So the stage fright and finding ways to just push through it, it's part of the process. And it's like a very rewarding part of the process that I wasn't thinking about it in any personal terms. It was just like, okay, I'm about to get on stage in front of 20 or 400 people. This is a normal feeling. But then to realize that it goes a lot deeper than that. And I think that would mostly come up when I was maybe performing something for the first time or something I had just finished writing or maybe hadn't even totally finished writing yet, and I was trying it out in front of a crowd. But that anxiety feeling of, like, I'm presenting a whole new idea that I don't know how they're going to react was really when I started to tune into how I personally interacted with this part of creative performance.
I wonder if you could tell us in your own words what eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, what it means.
Yeah, so it's a relatively new therapy for me. I had tried it briefly many years ago and just now revisited it maybe 6 months ago. And the most simplified way that I like to talk about it is it's a way to hold trauma and triggers and train your brain to use physical movements in some way, whether it be eye movement, which is sort of the historical origins of it, or I like to do tapping. Some people will use auditory left and right and have sounds play in headphones, but sort of trick the brain in a way to calm itself down when you're faced with triggers and trauma, and sort of creating these links and tools so that when you go outside of a therapy session and you're faced with something that causes anxiety, you can remember, okay, left and right, sort of rhythmic, and calm yourself down to a place where you can approach it with more logic than trigger.
Well, how does the practice work of it? What is the movement that you do to stimulate the left and then the right side of your brain?
Yeah, so I find that I do better accessing the emotional space you have to come from if my eyes are closed. So the light therapy doesn't work very well for me. So I like to keep my eyes closed, and I literally just sit in a chair and I have my left and right palms on my knees, and I just very slowly tap left and right in a rhythm. And that way, as we're talking through very difficult things, it sort of feels like walking or like marching, to have this stimulation on your left and right legs.
Right. So these are the motions that you're doing on the keyboard while you're performing, right?
Yeah, very, very much similar. It's maybe a little less rhythmic with my hands when I do keyboard, but when I perform, I'm usually playing a couple of keyboards at like chest level. And then I've also started using a lot of foot pedals, either for like keyboard bass, or I utilize a loop pedal when I'm performing live. So there's actually left and right with hands and feet happening on stage when I play live.
Now, folks in the know who read People magazine may have heard that Prince Harry practices EMDR every time he flies into London. It is gaining a much wider audience as it's becoming a bit more of a topic in therapy and in mental health. But when you first started doing it, had you ever heard of anybody else who was doing this?
I had. I was really lucky to have a small group of friends who are very transparent about what therapies work for them. And so I had had a couple of conversations with trusted folks about how it had helped them calm down these triggers. And so when I was looking for therapists most recently to find a new one during pandemic, I actually did a search based on who was qualified to do EMDR therapy.
Was it very hard to find someone?
There was a pretty decent selection. It was hardest to find people who practiced EMDR and had open availability, because it seems like a lot of people got very busy during the pandemic in therapy offices. So,
oh yeah,
I was able to find I think three people that I reached out to and then narrowed down to my therapist. Yeah,
being on stage is already kind of a balancing act. You're playing and you're singing. Many performers kind of read the audience, like you mentioned, and try to gauge their reaction, maybe even interact a little bit. Hopefully also you're getting into your own groove while you're up there. Was it difficult to develop this skill and to think about moving your hands in that way in addition to everything else that was going on?
You know, I think the movement came really naturally for me. And the link here is it's very normal for me to sort of have to do a consistent physical movement while I'm accessing trauma moments in therapy, or whether I'm singing about something really difficult that I went through. I'm used to holding like sort of a mathematical consistency with my movements while I access big emotions. What was different for me that I actually found kind of jarring was when you're doing it in front of an audience, there's this expectation that you're kind of holding it together. right? That you're like, you are staying on stage. You are staying composed enough to be singing, because singing is hard to do if you're crying. And that was a really big shift for me in therapy, is like, there's no one watching this. I think that was such a moment of creative shift for me, is like, what is the value for me in accessing these vulnerable moments with no one watching, or maybe one person watching, you know, with a therapist. But there's a different sort of expectation of holding it together that felt really different, even if the movements and the feelings were really similar.
Yeah. Jess, can you describe what the effect feels like when EMDR is practiced properly, when you're on stage and you're doing this? I mean, how does it feel?
Well, I think there is a difference. There's a difference between EMDR-like performance and the feeling that comes after, because you're literally met with applause, right? There's a sort of high when you do it successfully. But for me, in an EMDR session, it feels very much like you've peeled back a lot of layers and you're very raw. And so I think I'm still accessing a similar part of myself, but maybe that's the difference between doing it in front of an audience and doing it privately, right? Is that there's an expectation of sort of like a triumphant applause at the end of one, and at the other, you're like in your house closing your laptop.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jess Kramer. She's a musician who lives in Grand Rapids. And like so many other Michigan musicians, she's had to put the pause on performing this year. Unlike a lot of other musicians, though, this has also meant a pause on a form of therapy that she practices on stage. Jess, I know you have an 11-year-old son, and parents the world over have been making do with the wild lifestyle changes that everybody's been dealing with during COVID. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like for your family?
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, we were really, really lucky. Last March, when the schools shut down, and suddenly we were trying to figure out working from home and not sending my son off to school. We were very lucky. I co-parent with two other households. So my son, I guess the easiest way is sort of a relay race. I'm a single parent that splits time three ways. And he was able to stay home with someone at every household so he could maintain his same schedule. But for all of us, it was like, okay, well, when he's in school, we're also working, we're juggling, checking in on him, making sure that we can keep our work going. And it was suddenly just everything was based in the same space, you know, making music, me working my day job, his schooling was all in the same home. And we didn't get breaks from each other in the same way that we were used to, which, I mean, I really loved personally. I love being home with my son and can be sort of a homebody in that way, but it does affect your natural rhythm that you've gotten used to with social life and even just, you know, had to update my internet speed because suddenly we have all of these devices. Our education and our work are relying on being able to simultaneously do all of these things from home.
Yeah. We frequently talk to people who say they've had trouble just finishing reading a book during the pandemic. Did you have much of a creative process over the past year or so?
You know, it's interesting. I've really struggled to create anything new. What I have been able to do pretty well is revisit old things that weren't finished, sort of like reusing leftovers. So I've been working on a lot of unfinished songs from years back, and I haven't honestly written anything that I would consider a full song, but suddenly had this energy to sort of go back and revisit old things. That was strange. I released a new song about a year ago, June of 2020. But, I had been writing it for a while. I had started writing it pre-pandemic and was just able to finish and release it while everything was locked down.
Is that the song that you put out to celebrate Pride last year?
Yeah, I did. It was sort of a coincidental release. It was a love song that I wrote, so it was a gay love song, and thought that June was an apt time to put it out into the world. But that was also just when I felt like it was ready to share.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the writing it and, I guess, the finishing of it?
Yeah, I started writing that song probably 2 years before it actually came out. And I had performed it live a couple of times, tried out a couple of different versions. And it always felt really incomplete. And I think part of that is that the song is written about someone that I dated that it sort of left off without any closure. And I was really grappling with like how you can hold love and affection, admiration for someone and just not be able to explain why it didn't work. And so I think it was a struggle because a lot of times I use songwriting to write an ending to a feeling or to something that I went through, right? Sort of this zoom out of being able to make sense of something that I went through. And with this one, I couldn't find the part where it made sense. And so I was mirroring that very much in the songwriting process and in the production of it, and I couldn't find a way to end the song in a way that felt right. And it finally, I tried all of these things to add some closure to it and ended up with the fact that there wouldn't be closure. And that sometimes that's the most honest way to talk about a thing, is just to be like, I don't know what happened. Here's a song about it. So I decided just to finish it as it was, to finish the production and put it out into the world and to sort of let it be a loose end as a song.
The finished product is called Shake It. Let's take a listen.
Your presence is a blanket.
Jess, you just told us that you haven't really composed anything new in the past year. You've mostly just been working on things that you had already started writing, sometimes maybe years ago. But is there anything else creative that you're doing that's sort of been getting you through this time?
You know, it's funny. I think that creative energy's gotten sucked up so much. A lot of where my brain has gone is sort of the mathematical side of it, which my music is still pretty mathematical. When you're building things with a loop pedal, you know, it's very much in patterns and order and timing. But I feel like so much of my creative energy has just had to go to everyday things. What a creative reimagining of what work looks like, and a creative reimagining of what parenting looks like, and reimagining what friendships look like when you can't be in the same place. And so no, that creative generation has really just, it's been on pause in a musical sense. You know, there have been little ways that I've been able to do like live stream concerts for fans and perform. And I've, you know, recorded a couple of covers of other people's songs, some of which I did collaboratively and some of which I did solo. So it's been important for me to still make music, but to actually create new content, it feels like that well's been really dry. And it's been a real practice in patience to just sit with that as like the current reality as a musician. Just to know that it's not there right now. So how else can I keep at least, you know, picking up my instruments and finding joy in a creative process that looks a little bit different?
Mm-hmm. We're coming up on the date when Michigan is going to reopen capacity at venues. And there are starting to be rumblings about small gatherings and even shows. I know we spent the first part of this interview talking about this intimate and personal experience that you have during performance. Now I'm wondering, are you feeling like you might be ready to get back up on a stage?
I was actually really comforted by the idea of smaller capacity shows because I love that connection with a smaller room of people. And I love the idea of coming back from not having live shows for so long and sort of sharing that appreciation for that moment. I currently have decided only to perform outdoor shows. And the reason for that is my son is 11 and he's still not eligible for the vaccine. So as far as risk management, I feel like outdoor is a space that I feel safe and I'm really excited to connect by doing some outdoor performances. But, you know, down the road, if he is eligible for a vaccination, I think I'm ready to go back to an indoor venue. I think it's going to be really, it's going to be kind of terrifying to go back into that space that was so comforting for so long and to be like, oh, right, this is relearning how to perform in front of a crowd and how, you know, to show up as a person that's just been through a year and a half of processing all of these things alone and like dipping back into sharing it with a room of people. I'm really not sure how it's going to feel, but I hope I can get back to it in the next couple of months.
You figure out what it means all over again.
I think so, and I think that's the beauty of it, to come back as somebody slightly different.
Well, for now, we'll just say Jess Kramer's music can be found and experienced on Spotify and also on Bandcamp. And if you're looking for information on EMDR, there's information about that available online as well. Jess, it's been really nice talking to you. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.